Red Handed is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it. So your dollar goes a long way. Visit progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Chime is changing the way people bank. It's not just another banking app. Chime unlocks fee-free and smarter banking that's built for you, not the 1%. Forget overdraft fees, minimum balance fees, and monthly fees. Chime turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. Features like MyPay give you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime. And you can even get paid up to 2 days early. Earn up to 3% APY on your savings, 7 times higher than a traditional bank. And the Chime card is the newest way to unlock safer credit building and cashback all on one card, with no annual fees, no interest, and no strings attached. My younger self would really have benefited from something like this. Chime is not just smarter banking. It is the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services, a secured Chime Visa credit card, and MyPay line of credit provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. MyPay eligibility requirements apply, and credit limit ranges $20 to $500. Optional services and products may have fees or charges. See chime.com/fees info. Advertised annual percentage yield with Chime Plus status only. Otherwise, 1.00% APY applies. No min balance required. Chime card on-time payment history may have a positive impact on your credit score. Results may vary. See chime.com for details and applicable terms.
I'm Hannah.
And this is Red Handed. And today we're going to be talking about the murder of Annie Devani. On the 14th of November 2010, Annie Devani, a 28-year-old Swedish national, was found dead in an abandoned taxi in a notorious township in Cape Town. She had been shot in the neck and left to bleed to death. Annie was a newlywed in South Africa on her honeymoon following an insanely lavish wedding where she married British businessman Shirin Devani. And shortly after their wedding, the two left for the luxury honeymoon to South Africa. But their arrival in Cape Town would set off a chain of events that just 2 weeks after their fairy tale wedding would leave Annie Devani dead and Shirin accused of her murder. But did he do it?
This is a bit of a twisty-turny one, so pay attention. Yeah. America teacher. Remember this, it'll be on the quiz.
I know, attention is needed.
It is a big fat puzzle and we'll just be putting it together piece by piece. The main questions that circle this story and the ones that we will consider today are, did Shirin kill his wife? Was it a hit job? What is a hit job, Saruti?
Hitman job.
Hitman
An
job.
An execution job man.
Job
man, handyman, I don't know, hit job. Is that not what people say?
I don't know. Was it something else entirely? And how much did police incompetence and corruption contribute to all of the confusion?
Let's start at the beginning. Annie and her family were of Indian heritage, but Annie was born and raised in Sweden. She basically had everything going for her. I mean, we've posted pictures of her on the Instagram. You can see she's beautiful. She also had an engineering degree, so she was super smart. She had a family who loved her, and they were mega loaded. And in October 2010, she married Shirin Devani in this crazy expensive wedding. They spent like £150,000 on it, which is like, what, $190,000. I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot of money. I mean, not here in London. You couldn't buy a house for that. You couldn't buy anything. You buy a car parking space for a year for that. For a wedding, that's a lot of money. And I mean, I think the average is like £20,000 in this country to spend on a wedding. So they were well over that.
Is there a similar thing of like, you know, if you're buying an engagement ring, you're supposed to spend 2 months' wages on it?
I mean, I don't know. I think they were just really, really rich. Both their families are rich. And so why the hell not? They spend all this money on it. They are of Indian heritage, so it was just this full-on Indian Bollywood extravaganza wedding in Mumbai. When you see pictures of it, it's ridiculous.
How long would a normal Indian wedding be?
They were Hindu, Mm-hmm. And so I think Hindu weddings do go on a long time. And I think, like it is here, it's very much a status thing. How much money can you spend on it? How beautiful is her dress? They also do dress changes, so she'll have a couple of dresses over the 3 days.
Do they really ride in on elephants?
People do. My dad came to his
wedding. Did
he? Yeah, my dad came to his wedding on an elephant. But they got married in India. I won't have any elephants at my wedding. Yeah. This was a lavish wedding to match their riches. On both sides of the family.
So the couple had only known each other for about 18 months. Is that a normal amount of time, Indian style?
But the thing is, I think that they were of Indian heritage, but he was born and raised here, and she was born and raised in Sweden. I think that we can just say that this is comparable maybe to any other person.
Okay.
I guess, is it the older you get, the less time you need to be engaged? But then she was only 28. He was 35, but maybe in Indian culture, that is, I'm on the shelf. I'm 27, I'm on the shelf.
TikTok, seriously.
It is fast.
But not, like, not, crazy fast.
No. If one of your friends now met a guy and in a year and a half they got married, would that be crazy?
No, actually, it wouldn't, would it?
Exactly. Like, I'm almost her age. If we were at my wedding in a year and a half, that's not that crazy.
No, it's not. Yeah. You're right. I'll suspend my judgment. But they did get married, so everything seems, on the surface, pretty okay mm-hmm. at this point. It's not like a whirlwind romance, but it's...
No.
Their pictures give off the impression of a blissful relationship.
What do pictures prove?
Well, exactly. I would never, if I just had a fight with someone, I wouldn't take a picture.
No, but I also think it's like, isn't it always the couples that are constantly posting things on Facebook and on Instagram of pictures of themselves together that are
yes.
the most troubled deep down? Because I think there is, along with an insecure relationship, comes the need to bolster it
yes,
in
I
the
agree.
Eyes of others.
But according to Annie's family and friends, things had changed after the engagement. They claimed Shirin was controlling and that Annie had started to reveal doubts about the marriage. And as the wedding grew closer, she felt like she might be making a bit of a mistake. And there is evidence of Annie's trepidation. And the profile this builds of Shirin does a lot to explain why Annie's family to this day are convinced Shirin is guilty of Annie's murder. So what is this evidence? Annie had been texting her family members saying that she hated him and that she shouldn't have got engaged. And in other texts, Annie told her friends that they were fighting a lot and they have nothing in common because he's such a perfectionist. I think this is a lot more than cold feet.
This many doubts, this soon. They're not even married yet.
Mm.
And she's texting her family saying things like this. We shouldn't have got engaged. Why is she going through with it?
She was even heard saying that she wanted a divorce just days before the honeymoon. Literally immediately after they got married, she's yeah. like, this was a giant mistake.
Yeah, that's a huge red flag, especially the reason she cites why. The controlling behaviour, the perfectionism, especially to be with a perfectionist if you're not. Is very difficult.
I can understand, though, if they were planning this incredibly lavish wedding,
mm.
I can understand why you would think, well, we've spent all this money now, we're just going to have to do it.
Yeah, and I think there is also something to be said to come back to their backgrounds and issue of, this is what is expected, you've already yeah. decided this. But saying that, Shirin was engaged before he got engaged to Annie. He was engaged right. to another woman who was the daughter of the gentleman who... was the founder of SpiceJet, the airlines in Asia. And he broke that engagement off. But maybe this was Annie's, that she didn't want to go through with this. But despite any concerns that Annie may have harboured over her wedding to Devani, she married him anyway. And they left for their honeymoon in November 2010. Again, here, you know this idea that she went through with the wedding, she got married to him, and then left for the honeymoon, despite all of her misgivings, the fact that she... And also, if she was feeling pressure to not get married, she wasn't keeping it a secret. She was telling her family and friends, I don't want to marry him, I'm not sure about this, he's controlling. So it doesn't even seem like it was applied pressure from the family.
But what were they saying in return, though?
No, that's the thing, we don't know. I think they were saying, it'll be fine once you're married, it'll work itself out, which is very much the thinking I can imagine of that generation, which is, you learn to love someone after you're married.
Yeah.
Which is traditional, like, absolutely traditional in this kind of situation, I can imagine. But she's an intelligent woman. If you look at her, she doesn't come across like yeah. some traditional orthodox woman that was going along with what she was told. She seemed liberated. She was intelligent. She had her own life. She had her own skills. Why did she need to go along with this? What did she have to gain? It's hard to understand the mindset because of how vocal she was being by texting her family and yeah. friends saying this, which is what I think is bizarre. But on the 9th of November, so the start of their honeymoon, they fly to a luxury resort in Kruger National Park in northeastern South Africa. And Annie once again texts home saying, he's a nice guy, but I don't feel happy at all. But then a day later, Annie texts again. And here, something seems to have changed because now she texts home saying, it's getting better. It's going better than before. It's hard to explain. I'll call you when I'm back. And then again, she texts them, just hate the word divorce.
I can understand the stigma surrounding divorce, especially in quite a conservative situation, but that there's a very definite shift in how she's thinking about him. And
that's weird. I mean, what's going on with her? She seems quite fickle.
Is it too harsh to say that maybe everything was all right and she was just a bit of a dramatic person?
Maybe. There's only accounts from her family who are broken by her murder, talking about who she was and how she was. We don't know. Maybe she was a dramatic person. You know, after this text, her parents, I'm assuming, and her family will feel a little bit more relieved that they're on their honeymoon, things are working itself out. But to me and to us, it seems a bit crazy. But 4 days after the start of their honeymoon, they're done with the safari in Kruger National Park. 4 days after the safari, with things apparently going well between them now, the couple fly to Cape Town on the 12th of November for the rest of their trip. But within 30 hours of landing, Annie would be dead.
Let's do the timeline. We love a timeline. The couple land in Cape Town and they find a taxi driver at the airport. Zolo Robert Tongo. I feel like finding a taxi driver at the airport is very much a rich person's dealing with airports.
But in South Africa, I probably would.
I would have already arranged a car, is what I would have done.
Maybe that's a rich person thing to do, Hannah. I actually think that this is bizarre. I would have expected him. Why isn't their hotel picking them up? They are staying in a nice hotel. They don't have a shuttle bus. They don't have a taxi. They don't have a driver to come pick you up. He seems a perfectionist. Wouldn't you order a taxi when you order a car to be waiting for you?
Well, I'm surprised also that their hotel just didn't have someone.
Yeah. Is this a nice hotel? I googled it.
How nice.
Like, he's a millionaire. And her family are millionaires. They're not staying, and they're on their honeymoon.
Tongo is 30 years old and had just one conviction on his record at this point, which was for driving a taxi without a permit. So he's not a big hitter at this point.
No.
Or maybe he just hasn't been caught.
Maybe he's either very, very good or very petty. Like, it's hard to know.
Tongo would later go on to be the prosecution's star witness, testifying that Devani paid him to arrange Annie's execution. So that day, Tongo picks up the couple and drives them to their hotel, the Cape Grace, less than a 30-minute drive away from the airport. When they arrive at the hotel, Annie goes inside to check in. Devani hangs back to speak with Tongo. Apparently, he tells Tongo, just right now, this second, outside their hotel, that he wants to take someone off the scene. He literally just met this guy in a taxi.
And they were in the car together for like 25 minutes.
That is not enough time to feel someone out, to ask them to kill someone. Yeah, the drive from the airport was 25 minutes. In Tongo's statement to the police, he claimed that Devani said he wanted someone to be killed. I told him I didn't associate myself with such things, but could call someone in the township who might be able to help. And that's a crazy risk for a perfectionist.
Exactly. And I think this is what it comes back to, the claims around this is how he's doing it. It seems weird. This is how a perfectionist like Shirin Devani would go about this.
A millionaire perfectionist kills his wife.
Maybe it's the double bluff. But we don't know. Shirin Devani is now apparently allegedly conspiring to commit murder with a random taxi guy he just met in a strange foreign city. Shirin now joins Annie in the hotel lobby while Tongo waits outside. After checking in, Shirin goes back outside to speak with Tongo for almost 9 minutes. This is all corroborated by CCTV. But as far as what they discuss, Tongo and Devani, as with the rest of their interactions from here on out, have two wildly different stories. Devani says that he was discussing hiring Tongo to be their driver whilst they were in Cape Town. Tongo says Devani was talking cash. He wanted to have a woman murdered, and he wanted to know how much it would cost. Firstly, if Annie was the target, why didn't Shirin just identify her as the target?
She was in the car.
Tongo's met her. Why be so shady being, I need someone taken off the scene, I need a woman taken off the scene? But again, all of this is corroborated by CCTV in terms of we can see what's happening, but we don't know what they're actually saying. Devani wants to murder his new wife in a cold-blooded, premeditated way, and he just turns up with no pre-planning, no idea, and randomly just asks the taxi driver to engage in a conspiracy to murder his new wife, the same man who was described by Annie and his family and his friends and basically anyone who knew him as a perfectionist and a control freak. Maybe if you were going to commit murder, you would go to a random country where you thought maybe their criminal justice system wouldn't be very good.
Yes, I definitely would do that. I'd never kill someone anyway, but if I were going to, I wouldn't
kill them here.
I wouldn't kill them in the UK. No way. But if I was his sort of level of anally retentive perfectionist, it would all just happen as all I would have to do is walk out of the airport. It would all be in place already. I wouldn't be picking up taxi drivers and being like, hey man, you look like you could probably murder someone. Do you want to help me out?
But is it this idea of if you plan everything too well, there's a paper trail. They can trace it back. If you just go do it off the cuff when you get there, there's less chance of it being traced back to you because there is a sense of chaos around it and it's less likely to be led back to you. And, you know, when you go travelling, they always say, don't book anything in advance. Sort it out when you're there because you'll get a better rate.
Well, this is the thing about the car at the airport, isn't it?
Why is he hiring this random guy to drive them around? Doesn't their hotel have someone who can organise a taxi?
Yeah, not only should their hotel... I find it very difficult to believe their hotel didn't have airport pickup. Mm-hmm. I find it very difficult to believe they didn't have drivers. Mm-hmm. That you could hire.
Unless he wanted to give his money to a local person. I would do that.
I would do that. I understand that. But he just doesn't seem like that kind of guy.
I know. But again, this idea that the South African authorities would later go on to say that they felt he had come there and committed the murder there in this erratic sense because he felt that their justice system was weak and that their police department wouldn't have caught him and that he came there with a sense of hubris and arrogance.
I can buy that.
I can buy that.
So let's continue the story and we'll, as we go along, we'll let you know what CCTV corroborated and what's alleged. After Tongo leaves the couple, he drives to another hotel, the Colosseum, which is a 20-minute drive from the Cape Grace. On the way, he called the Colosseum to speak to the receptionist, a man named Omblombo. He's the middleman in the whole plot. Tongo calls him to apparently arrange the hit. So meanwhile, back at the Cape Grace, while all this is happening, Shireen leaves Annie in their hotel room and goes out, clearly seen on CCTV.
Yeah, and the CCTV back at the Colosseum shows Tongo arriving to meet Omblombo. So after Tongo left Shireen and Annie at their hotel, he calls Omblombo, drives to the Colosseum, and here he's seen by CCTV. They go outside, and Tongo tells Omblombo that he has a man who is willing to pay 15,000 rand, which is about £900 or about $1,000, for a hit on a woman. Omblombo said he knew a guy in the township who could carry out the hit. Now, they were outside for just 2.5 minutes.
It's not long enough.
Is that enough time to organise an execution?
Of your wife?
Or a hit job, whatever. But when they come back inside, the CCTV shows another employee, because the CCTV in the Colosseum also has sound, which is really important to this case. So when they come back inside, the CCTV shows another employee jokingly asking them what's going on. And Omblombo jokingly replies, you don't want to know.
Mm. Funny joke on Blombo.
I know.
Good joke.
But again, things can get taken out of context. They could have been talking about some lady or anything, you know?
That's true.
Yeah.
Special lady friend.
Are these guys first-time murderers? Neither of them had previous convictions, apart from driving that taxi permit. I mean, that's paperwork. That's not criminal activity. It's like not having a TV license. And now suddenly they're criminal kingpins with connections to hitmen.
Just because they haven't been, because they have no convictions, because the justice system is a bit all over the place.
Yeah.
They could be.
Yeah, yeah.
Super kingpins who only need 2.5 minutes and they're absolutely like, that's all I need, buddy. I've got it.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe they don't is because there's corruption in the police force and that's why they've never been convicted of anything.
If you were going into some organised crime ring and you're just a random person, you're not from the country and you find, you know, the mafia or the triads or whatever and you just walk up to them being like, I need you to kill someone for me. They don't know you. You could be a cop. Like, why would they ever just be like, okay, straight, well, you have to prove yourself to a certain extent. And I don't think that happens.
No. And I think, but I think that's an absolute valid point somewhere like here. But I think there, so in South Africa, in Cape Town, I think how much of it is that these guys are not criminally sophisticated. They're not high up the criminal ladder, but for £900, you're getting a hit on somebody, on your new wife. Maybe there you don't need to go that all that high up the criminal ladder.
No.
In order to find someone who is a hitman. Here, people talk about it on the dark web, like the dark web is where you go to find a hitman.
But I just don't think, even in that circumstance, you'd be able to find someone so quickly.
Oh yes, I think the idea of how, with what level of ease he does this is very bizarre.
Do you know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of, like, Panama or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's all these people walking around, they're like, hey, man, cocaine, cocaine,
yeah,
cocaine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it makes me feel like, oh, cocaine?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hey, man, like, what, yeah, yeah. What do you need?
Maybe it's easier to find this kind of stuff because the black market is very much in your face. I don't know. It's bizarre.
In any case, whatever they were up to, because they're definitely up to something, they are seen calling a guy called Kwabe. Kwabe is a young unemployed man from a township in the area. Once Mblomba had called Kwabe to set things up, alleging the hit ordered by Shirin, Tongo leaves and Mblomba is clearly seen on hotel CCTV looking ridiculously happy, smiling and dancing and joking. Is that the behaviour of a man who's just organised a hit? He's been the middleman.
Maybe. He's going to get a payoff? Yeah. And he's a stone-cold psychopath?
Doesn't seem smart enough for a psychopath to me, I don't think.
Sociopath?
Maybe. Now, let's go back to the Cape Grace. Roughly at the same time, around 6:15, as Tongo is leaving the Colosseum, Devani returns to his hotel. He'd been to a bureau de change and had... I never know how to say that in my own accent.
Yeah, I know. I think it's because it's French, so it's like, oh, he'd been to a bureau de change.
I was like, yeah, I know, because I can't be like, bureau de change.
Like, don't say that. Or say it exactly like that.
I don't know, I never know no. where to pitch it.
Bureau de change.
Bureau de change.
You're posh enough to pull that off.
Thanks. And he had changed £800 into rand. He also had with him a single red rose for Annie. That's nice. That's a nice thing to do on your honeymoon.
If you're not about to murder her.
Minutes after Shirin returns to his room, Annie calls her parents. And in an interview, the family now say that she sounded weird. They said that it wasn't Annie's voice, and that something just felt not okay.
This would also sadly be the last time that they would ever speak. And things develop and escalate very quickly now. So at 6:40, Tongo calls Kwabe, the first gunman. He's calling to confirm that Kwabe can do the job. He then calls another guy, Mugeni, who becomes the second gunman. The four guys involved now are Tongo, who was the taxi driver, Mblomba, who's the receptionist at the Colosseum and is the middleman setting everything up, Kwabe, who's the first gunman, and Mugeni, who's the second gunman. So the prosecution's case is that in just two calls, one to Kwabe lasting 79 seconds and one to Mugeni lasting 41 seconds, Tongo had hired Annie's killers. Tongo, a man who previously had no convictions or links to criminal activity on this level.
Doesn't feel right, does it?
No, it doesn't. It seems a bit suspect to me. But meanwhile, back at the Cape Grace, so the hotel where Annie and Shirin are staying, that night CCTV shows them having dinner near their hotel.
The waitress who served them at dinner remembers that they were not a typical honeymoon couple. She said in an interview that she was always serving honeymooners and that the Devanis didn't seem loved up enough. At one point, she even comes over to the table and Shirin isn't there. And Annie says he's gone to make a business call. Who the fuck does that on their honeymoon?
That's humiliating. I'd be humiliated.
I would be beside myself. I'd probably storm off. I wouldn't, like, sit there quietly. I would leave.
And in the, like, CCTV pictures, she looks pissed. She's got her arms crossed. She's, like, slumped back in her chair. And she looks like she's fucking pissed off.
I don't blame her at all.
But what was really happening, though, was he on a business call?
When you look at the CCTV, it looks like Shirin had actually left his phone in their hotel room and was going back to retrieve it. If you're in a strange country and you've just arrived literally how many days ago?
Not long,
a couple of days. And in that time, you've managed to orchestrate a hit job on your wife. Why would you leave your phone in your hotel room? These people who you've hired to kill your wife are communicating with you exclusively through your phone. Why would you not have it with you at all times? Someone could see it, something could pop up on the screen. That's not the behaviour of a man who's organised a hit.
Well, not the behaviour of a man who has got his shit together and has organised a hit.
Especially since phone records show that he had a text from Tongo waiting for him when he got back in his room. So anyone could have seen it. But Shirin comes back with his phone, calls Tongo, and they speak for 5 minutes and 26 seconds.
Yes, there is no real clear evidence of Devani's involvement in the guilt of Annie's death, in what we've said so far. But the frequency and the timings of the calls is what is so suggestive of his guilt to me. They're just so suspicious. Why does he keep having to have these calls with Tongo? That call he makes to Tongo when he comes back and sees the text, he makes it at the hotel while his wife is waiting for him at the restaurant still.
With a face like a smacked ass, probably.
And 5.5 minutes. What are you talking about?
That is a long time for someone you don't know.
And why is he texting you? Again, why are you calling him? The kind of frequency and the timings of these calls makes it all very bizarre to me. So what were they talking about? Because the CCTV proves that they were speaking, the phone records prove that they were speaking, but we don't know what they were talking about, apart from what either of them alleged. So Shirin says they were talking about the tours that they were arranging. Because remember, he had asked Tongo to be his driver while they were in Cape Town. And if this was just about Tongo being their driver and itinerary planning, why so many calls? And at night?
Well, maybe...
while his wife is waiting at the restaurant.
See, yeah, that's bullshit. But maybe the only thing I can think of is if he's like, oh, I'm going to take you on these tours and each tour is going to cost you this amount of money. Every time Shireen is saying yes, he's like, great, I've got him. I'll offer him another one and another one and another one and another one. So that I can see, kind of. But still, five... maybe he was just trying to get him off the phone, but he seems like the kind of bloke who's not afraid to just hang up the phone.
He's a businessman. I don't feel like you get to that position taking calls that you don't want to be taking.
True.
After their evening out, at about 11:30, the couple return to their room. Tongo tells the police that Shireen now calls him to pick them up. But there is no record of Shireen calling Tongo at this point. But there does seem to have been some sort of prearranged plan. Again, why? Tongo, we'll see this throughout the case. He lies about things that are inconsequential. He lies about things that prove nothing. So they could have arranged this during the 5.5 minutes they spoke about midway through dinner. Why lie that Shireen called him then to come pick him up? In any case, at 11:56 that night, Tongo arrives to pick Shireen up. They leave the Cape Grace and head to a jeweler's to exchange money. Here, Shireen exchanges $1,500 into Rand. So now if you add this amount to the money from before, Shireen now has about 21,500 Rand.
And also, almost midnight, I would not carry a large amount of money outside a hotel with me.
No.
Anywhere in the world.
Why? Why? But again, is this a sign of his arrogance and his hubris? Nothing can happen to me, that kind of reckless behaviour. It is weird, but that is what he does. So now, yeah, 21,500 Rand.
Why did he need so much money? Supposedly, he needed 15,000 Rand for the murder. But if he wasn't planning a hit, why take out so much cash? But he has more than he needs.
Yeah, because it's like, so it's like, he needs 15,000 for the murder. But mm-hmm. if he isn't plotting a murder, why is he taking out so much money?
Right. According to Shireen, he had been planning a secret surprise for Annie, a helicopter trip. Which, again, why are you arranging this at midnight?
Or why are you going to get money out for this? Maybe he just wants to do it the next day and he needs to go get that money out.
Yeah, maybe he like just had the thought and he was like, okay, we can just do it.
They're staying in nice places. This is 2010. Why is your card not working? He's a millionaire. What does he care? Even if it's got a little bit of a charge on it. Stick it on the card. Who's getting cash out? Driving around to jewellers.
Put it on your room. Why would you not?
Because this is the other hotel that offers it.
Oh, okay, I see.
They're staying at the Cape Grace, but the Coliseum is the one that offers the helicopter ride.
Okay.
That he alleges was what the money was for.
Because the Coliseum is where Omblombo works, mm-hmm. and he offered the helicopter ride. The only hotel that offers a helicopter ride is the Coliseum where Omblombo works. Mm-hmm. And you can even hear staff on CCTV talking about the rich people who wanted the helicopter trip. He's not trying to appear poor, do you know what I mean? He's flashing his cash about.
I think you can say that. He's flashing his cash about.
Which
I
is
think
dumb.
Just behave with, like, appropriateness. Hide your valuables. You don't go in there shouting about this and this and this and, like, taking Tongo to go exchange cash. He knows exactly how much cash you're exchanging now. I'm not saying everyone there is some criminal that's going to rob you, but behave with a little decorum, maybe.
You're only as safe as you make yourself. That
Absolutely.
Is my mantra for world travel.
You don't walk around with your fucking brand new iPhone strapped to your chest and, like, a GoPro on your head and everything. You're asking for something to happen.
What's very interesting is a helicopter trip from the Coliseum is about the same amount a hit would have cost. The police never really explore this. I doubt there's like a set amount for a hit.
No. But it was the amount they had alleged. So the 15,000 Rand is how much the helicopter flight cost and how much they said the hit cost. So it explains why, if he wasn't arranging the hit, why he kept taking out so much cash.
So after the jewellers, Tongo takes Shireen straight back to the Cape Grace. Tongo tells the police that Shireen, during this 10-minute journey, specifies how he wants Annie to be killed.
Yeah, so he's saying, like, he wants it to be made to look like a hijacking. He wants it to be cut and shut. He doesn't want to be there when it's happening. This is apparently how he's specifying he wants it done.
But at the same time, he's leaving so much to chance. Mm-hmm. After dropping Shireen back at his hotel, Tongo heads to the township to meet the gunmen. Here, the three men, Tongo, Kwabe and Mageni, plan the murder. The plan was apparently for the gunman to hijack the car and kill Annie. But what is really interesting is that there was no evidence that Tongo ever confirmed any of this with Shireen.
Exactly. So Shireen is plotting this murder using men he doesn't know, in a country he doesn't know, insists that the murder happens soon because they're running out of time. They're on a honeymoon. They're not there for an extended period of time. but doesn't need any confirmation that everything is set. Isn't that weird? If you were going to kill someone, is this how you would do it?
Absolutely fucking not.
Or maybe he's, like, playing 4D chess.
What, maybe it's a quadruple bluff?
Yeah.
That is the sort of thing a perfectionist would do.
Yeah, and if he is some sort of psychopath.
Maybe he's playing at our own game.
Exactly, exactly. We don't know. So while all this is happening, the couple go for dinner. And at the Colosseum Hotel, Omblombo calls Tongo. I listened to the recordings on the CCTV that had been translated, and they are 100% planning something. But they're never specific, so it's so hard to know what they're actually referring to. They're doing something. They're planning something. They're talking about it so vaguely that apart from knowing they're planning something, you can't be sure what it is that they're doing. But whatever is going down, Omblombo is definitely in charge. After their meeting at 7:45, Shirin and Tongo speak on the phone. Regarding the call, Tongo insists that Shirin is calling him to insist that the murder happens soon and that he needs them to get on with it. But what's really interesting is that CCTV at the bar that the Devanis are at shows Shirin is taking the call in front of Annie. I mean, when you watch the CCTV, they're sat at a tiny little table, like a little poser table. They're just sat there together. They're like very intimate. They're like basically on top of each other. He's got his hand like stroking her hair while he's on the phone to Tongo, because the phone records prove it. Tongo is saying that during this call, Shirin is demanding that the hit happen and telling them how he wants it done and that they need to get on with it.
And she's right next to him.
She's next to him. And in the CCTV, he looks completely at ease. She sat right there. Is he ordering Annie's murder in front of her?
No.
No.
This episode is a paid ad by BetterHelp. Let's take a moment to think about the women in our lives. Those who've transformed the way we think, behave, and see ourselves. Those who've taken on a serious and often invisible emotional weight to take care of those closest to them. March means International Women's Day. It's a time that celebrates strength and progress, but can also highlight how much is asked of women every day. From supporting loved ones to managing responsibilities that often go unseen, it's easy for emotional well-being to get pushed aside. No matter your stage of life or relationship status, therapy can help you check in with yourself, understand what's feeling heavy, and build healthier pathways moving forward. With over 30,000 therapists worldwide, BetterHelp is one of the leading online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/redhanded. That's betterhelp.com/redhanded. I am fed up with influencers telling me I need a complicated 10-step skincare routine just to take care of my skin. That's why I've defected to OneSkin. Their products aren't about hype or fancy packaging. They're based on real science. OneSkin's research boffins discovered OS1, a game-changing peptide that works to slow down the skin's aging process at the source. Every time I do my new routine, I'm basically deploying a crack squad to repair damaged cells, support collagen production, and strengthen my skin barrier. Born from over a decade of longevity research, OneSkin's OS1 peptide is proven to target the visible signs of aging, helping you unlock your healthier skin now as you age. For a limited time, try OneSkin with 15% off using code redhanded at oneskin.co/redhanded. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code redhanded. After your purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Chime is changing the way people bank. It's not just another banking app. Chime unlocks fee-free and smarter banking that's built for you, not the 1%. Forget overdraft fees, minimum balance fees, and monthly fees. Chime turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. Features like MyPay give you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime. And you can even get paid up to 2 days early. Earn up to 3% APY on your savings, 7 times higher than a traditional bank. And the Chime card is the newest way to unlock safer credit building and cashback, all on one card, with
no annual fees, no interest, and no strings attached. My younger self would really have benefited from something like this. Chime is not just smarter banking. It is the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services, a secured Chime Visa credit card, and MyPay line of credit provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. MyPay eligibility requirements apply, and credit limit ranges $20 to $500. Optional services and products may have fees or charges. See chime.com/fees info. Advertised annual percentage yield with Chime Plus status only. Otherwise, 1.00% APY applies. No min balance required. Chime card on-time payment history may have a positive impact on your credit score. Results may vary. See chime.com for details and applicable terms.
Whatever they spoke about, Tonga arrives at the hotel to pick them up 30 minutes later, because apparently Tonga and Shirin had organised a nighttime sightseeing tour of the city. Why would you ever do that? I think...
on your honeymoon as well. Have you got something else to be doing?
At nighttime.
I'd find something else. Nighttime. Mate. All the time.
Just made myself look like a bit of a prude there.
At nighttime.
Missionary only, no eye contact.
We're here for the conception. Get on with it.
Sorry. Also, this tour, which is just bonkers, it took them to a township and a super notorious township that's famous for gun crime. That's not a honeymoon activity in anyone's book, I don't think.
No, I don't think it's part of, like, the premium package, honeymoon package, you know? What do you think? This idea of, like, slum tourism. Like, they were going to the townships.
Yeah, like people who, like, go and look at a favela in Brazil.
And the Mumbai slums, it's a very popular tourist attraction.
It makes me feel really gross, is what it makes me feel.
But then is it this idea of, like, people should come, get out of their resorts and come take a look at how normal people live, or how, not normal people, but the majority of people in that country are living.
I do get that. I'm not, like, someone who goes on an all-inclusive holiday and stays in the resort and eats only English food. They exist. But there is something that unnerves me a little bit about, like, shall we just go and look at some poverty, shall we?
Yeah. It's all very, like, colonial, isn't it?
That's exactly it. And it makes me feel uncomfortable.
It is. It's weird, but that's exactly what they do.
I think it is important to say, just because of what the waitress said previously, Shirin and Annie, they look super coupley right now. Mm-hmm. The CCTV in the bar shows them all over each other. They're kissing and taking photos, and they look like they haven't before, which is in love. Is Shirin just that much of a psycho? Is he a stone cold...
This idea, though, again, if you are planning a hit that night, your wife is going to get murdered, and you've planned it. Yes, I would go to a packed bar, and I would ask people to take photos of us. He's asking strangers to take photos of them. He's got his arms all around her, but so is she. But she doesn't know what's going on, and maybe he doesn't. But that is the perfect setup for the tragic loss of my beloved wife.
You're right.
Is that a thing? I don't know.
I could believe that. Especially if that's the only night and that they've looked like that and been seen to be coupley and it's the night she's murdered.
But their relationship is so tumultuous anyway. Look back at the texts that Annie was sending. In their wedding photos, they look genuinely happy. They don't look like the smile that doesn't reach the eyes. They are smiling, yeah. And they look happy. They blew £150,000 on that wedding. Everything was so expensive. They went for it, full force, to get married. But she's still texting people being like, oh, I'm not sure if I should have got married. I'm not sure if we should have got engaged. I'm not sure about him. He's controlling, whatever. Like, and then the next day she texts them and saying everything is getting better. Like, their relationship anyway seems quite dramatic and tumultuous. So maybe that night they were with the other waitress. She picks up on the fact they don't seem coupley, but then now suddenly they are.
I can buy both sides of that story. But let's get back to this weird tourist township tour that they're doing late at night. Tongo takes them to Gultu Township. Tongo drove Shirin and Annie into the heart of the township at night, straight into the hands of the gunman.
This is where Kwabe and Mugeni were laying in wait. They ambushed the taxi at gunpoint. And I can only imagine the panic. In the dark, being set upon, Shirin said they were screaming for money, so we gave them all the money he had. And he was yelling at Annie to give them everything because she wouldn't give them her wedding and engagement rings. Tongo now gets out the car, and the gunmen now tell the Diwanis they're not going to kill them as long as they give them everything they want. The gunmen say they will let them go, but only separately. So they stop and demand that Shirin gets out. Shirin says he was begging for the gunmen to let him and Annie go together, but Kwabe is screaming at him to get out. Get out of the taxi and move. Shirin says Kwabe had a gun to his head, so he gets out, and the taxi drives away with Annie. Shirin is now left alone, stranded in the township. Luckily for Shirin, a local government auditor, Simbonelli Matakazi, finds him and calls the police. Matakazi says Shirin was frantic when he found him.
So really, we can't know 100% what's happened during the hijacking, but Kwabe and Tongo say that Shirin was 100% in on it and handed over the money and just got out of the taxi willingly, leaving Annie to die. But the second gunman, Mugeni, is the only one to tell the same story as Shirin. The statement Mugeni gives before Shirin becomes a suspect absolutely mirrors Shirin's story. Mugeni confirms that Shirin was screaming, "Don't kill her and don't kill us." So Shirin is picked up by the police, and after a fruitless search for Annie, they return Shirin to his hotel at 1 a.m. on Sunday morning. In the CCTV, he looks distraught, but the police are telling him they are confident they will absolutely find Annie alive. Annie is already dead. She was killed not long after Shirin was thrown out. Once again, there are two stories. The gunmen both blame each other for shooting Annie. We think it was Kwabe. The forensics point in that direction, which we'll come on to later, and they do seem to incriminate him.
And this is the idea of like, okay, so say it was a hijacking. It wasn't organised by Devani. It was organised by Tongo. Why did they take Annie and kick Shirin out? She's hysterical. She's screaming. He's screaming. What is there to be gained by separating them and driving away with Annie?
I know that's something I don't understand either. What if they're just going to steal them and kill them both? What I absolutely don't understand is why you would let the bloke get out of the car and keep the woman unless you're going to rape her. That's the only thing I can think
of. And she wasn't. There was no sexual assault. There was no rape. Nothing happened like that to Annie. It doesn't make sense because especially this woman who is screaming, because you would be. You would be screaming. You would be hysterical.
Absolutely.
Why take her with you? Unless it is to disorientate them. If they're together, maybe they'll get their shit together sooner. But they're still. You're leaving them in a strange township miles away from their hotel. What are they going to do? Why not leave them together?
Also, if Shirin had organised the hit, if I had done that, I wouldn't want to be left in the middle of a township famous for gun violence.
Absolutely.
I would want someone to come and pick me up and take me away.
Definitely.
Or I wouldn't be there in the first place.
Or you would be like, shoot her, throw her out and drive me back. Why would you throw me out first? Unless it is again to be seen. And he has the sense of like arrogance and again hubris that nothing will happen to him and he'll be fine. Even if that's not the case, maybe it's because of what Shirin was saying. He was screaming at Annie to give them her rings, and she wasn't. So maybe they thought, we've taken everything we can from Shirin, because he's, and this is assuming that he didn't organise this, he's playing ball. Get him out, and she will become more compliant when he's not there, because she's not giving them her rings. Which again, why wouldn't you? Take it, take the fucking rings. But that's what she's doing. Maybe that's why they separate her. They want to get the jewellery off that she hasn't given up yet.
Either way, after Annie was shot, they abandoned the taxi in Kailiche Township with Annie shot and dying in the backseat. They stole her handbag, both of their mobile phones and jewellery. Everything except Annie's rings, including Annie's engagement ring, which was £25,000.
That's insane.
I would be so terrified having something that expensive on me, ever.
Again, I just find it very weird that they went to this place on honeymoon. Unless it was because they were planning on this luxury honeymoon, why wouldn't you wear your £25,000 engagement ring? But
maybe, if I was travelling anywhere, I wouldn't wear it.
Nope.
I was staying in a hotel in Vietnam, and I had, like, it wasn't even real gold, just a chain. And the guy who ran the hotel was like, take that off.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
If it was a murder made to look like a robbery, why would you leave the rings? That seems like a miscalculation.
So the ring was found in the car. I mean, if it was a murder made to look like a robbery, why leave the rings? The only thing I can think is that she wouldn't give them up for whatever reason, because when they do find them, one of the rings is found under her body, so she's passed out on top of it when she's been shot, and then the other ring is found in, like, the footwell of the back of the car. But still, why would you leave them? And if it was an execution, wouldn't they have stayed to check that she was dead? Apparently, they just ran off after she'd been shot. And also, if it was an execution, does it seem like an execution, or does it seem like an accidental shooting?
If it's an execution, I feel like you shoot them in the temple or the back of the head, you know?
Yeah, it was a single shot, and the shot had first hit Annie's left hand, then entered her neck, severing major blood vessels and slashing her spinal cord. The South African police concluded that this was an execution. But who shoots someone in the neck when it's an execution? Through their hand?
No. I feel like if you're executing someone, you restrain them, so she wouldn't have been able to have her hands in front of her face.
No. And you shoot them in the back of the neck. You don't shoot someone in the face, basically. Through their hand.
It feels very rushed. It doesn't feel...
It sounds like an accidental discharge.
Absolutely.
To me.
But when the case was reviewed here by an independent UK Home Office pathologist, he found that the gunshot looked much more like a shot from very close range, much more likely to be a result of a struggle.
Yeah, as opposed to what South African police confirmed, that it was an execution.
However, the South African police didn't run with this. They carried out no experiments. The South African police failed to collect all of the evidence or properly analyse what they did have. They were happy to just take confessions and offer plea bargains. Basically, the South African police were after Shirin Devani for this. Those who took plea bargains or got off completely scot-free all gave one account pointing the finger at Shirin. But Mungeni, the second gunman, was the only one not to take a plea bargain, told a story that fits Shirin's account. Kwabi, the first gunman, says they found the envelope full of the 15,000 rand for the hit in the backseat, as promised. Mungeni, who was the only one not to implicate Shirin, said they only split the money they had stolen from Shirin at gunpoint, the 4,000 rand. And there is evidence that Mungeni spent around 2,000 rand the next day on trainers and clothes. If they had the full 15,000, where is it gone? Where is the rest of the money? They never found it. It never surfaced.
Just had a thought. Did it go to Omblombo?
Could have done. I hate plea bargains so much. Oh, yeah. I think they are such a pestilence on the legal system. You can't believe anything that comes out of a plea bargain testimony, in my opinion.
It's like torture testimony, like under duress. Like no confessions given under plea bargains or given under torture are legitimate or admissible. It's bollocks, absolute bollocks. But back to the 14th of November, the day they find Annie. It's 9:20 a.m. and CCTV shows Shirin taking the call from the police that Annie is dead and that her body's been found. The police, a doctor, and family friends are with him when he found out, and the CCTV shows he is hysterical. But the CCTV also catches Shirin's shifting emotions over the next few hours. 10 hours after, he's smiling on the phone to a friend. And the next day, on the way to the mortuary, he's once again visibly distressed. I mean, the whole thing of like, oh, well, he was laughing on the phone with a mate 10 hours after. Amanda Knox.
Totally. People deal with grief in different ways. I think a person is most likely to behave erratically after they've just had some awful... And he also has just been through a traumatic experience himself. He was there.
Absolutely. And I think this idea of like a brief reprieve of like the CCTV literally shows him walking out of a room, out of his room on the phone to his friend. He's caught on CCTV about 3 seconds from his room to when he's out of sight. And yes, he's laughing 10 hours after he's found out his wife is dead. But that's a 3-second window into what's happening that you've just seen.
Lots of people laugh when they're uncomfortable. I laugh when I'm uncomfortable. I don't know how to handle a situation.
Yeah. But then did he look uncomfortable and visibly distressed on the way to the mortuary the next day just purely because he's about to see the dead body of a wife he murdered? It doesn't prove that he's sad that she's dead.
No, it absolutely doesn't prove. In the same way, him laughing on the phone doesn't prove jack shit either.
No. Before leaving South Africa, Shirin meets Tongo one last time. And this is a weird meeting. And at this point, Shirin is only a witness and not a suspect. And obviously neither is Tongo, because he's free. Tongo says that he came to get the 5,000 rand as payment for his driving. Shirin and Tongo go into like an internet room in the hotel where there's no CCTV. Shirin enters with a white plastic bag and leaves a few minutes later without the bag.
Tongo also exits soon after with the bag under his shirt and goes straight to the toilet. Tongo says he's only got 1,000 rand. He leaves the hotel with the bag in clear view. He says he went looking for Shirin to confront him about the short change. Side note, you drove him and his wife into a fatal situation. No, you're not getting paid the full whack, mate.
Yeah. There's no proof that he was shortchanged either.
I wouldn't pay him a fucking anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, no, I probably would, because I would be like, oh, I'm sorry that you were there and blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, yeah. Because as far as Shirin thinks at this point, this poor man was just caught up in it and also got thrown out of his taxi.
Yeah, that's fair. I would pay him. But yeah, you're right. There's no evidence of it being
just more evidence shortchanged. Of Tongo lying.
The CCTV shows that he didn't. He just left the hotel. He says Shirin then calls Tongo 1 hour and 40 minutes after giving him the bag. The call lasts about 54 seconds, and Tongo never mentions this call.
Why was Shirin calling him anyway? You've paid him, you've given him the money, and it's not Tongo confronting him like he told the police he did, for being shortchanged. Shirin is calling Tongo almost 2 hours after he's given him the money. What could they possibly have to talk about anymore?
What I could understand is if it was Tongo calling Shirin and being like, yeah, I'm so sorry. But that's not what happened. It's Shirin calling
Unless
him.
Unless Shirin called him and said, do you know anything about what happened? Do you know those men? Is there any connection? Is there anything you saw that might help the police in their investigation? But why wouldn't you have that conversation when he came to the hotel?
What was the money for? Is it just for the taxi or is it the hit money? And just why is Tonga lying about it again? It doesn't mean anything. It's inconsequential, I think. Either way, the investigation rolls on and Tonga was arrested a week after Annie's death. The very next day, Tonga takes a plea bargain in exchange for testimony against Shirin Devani.
So on the 7th of December 2010, the plea bargains were rubber stamped and Tonga was offered 7 years instead of 25 for his part in the murder, which was, as he alleged, organising a middleman to organise a hit for Shirin Devani. And with that, Shirin was officially a suspect. Now, Shirin had already left South Africa and returned to the UK. And on the 8th of November, so the day after Tonga's arrest, Shirin is arrested in the UK at the request of the South African authorities on suspicion of conspiracy to murder. The South African Justice Department makes its intentions very clear. Once they had more documentation from its prosecutors, it will initiate full extradition proceedings to get Devani back to Cape Town to stand trial for the murder of his wife. And if found guilty, he faces life. Shirin later appears in the City of Westminster Magistrates Court to also make his intentions clear. He will not consent to extradition.
I bloody wouldn't either.
Fuck that. No way. Whether I was guilty, whether I was innocent, there is no way I would consent to extradition to South Africa to stand trial.
Annie's family, however, completely back the South African authorities. They were, and remain, convinced that Shirin killed Annie. In January 2011, Devani's lawyer claims his client is suffering from an acute stress disorder. Therefore, extradition proceedings are adjourned. And just over a month later, Shirin takes a cocktail of 46 pills, including diazepam. And by April, Shirin was detained in the medium security from Side Clinic in Bristol under the Mental Health Act. So he's sectioned, essentially.
He's got PTSD. He must do.
He has to. And also,
if he's innocent. Or he's faking.
Yeah.
If he's guilty.
46 pills, that is a suicide attempt.
Which is really interesting because once the suicide attempt happens, the South African authorities ask, you need to revoke his bail. He needs to be on remand. You need to hold him in custody because he's trying to kill himself to get out of this. Devani's psychiatrist and lawyer say, that wasn't a suicide attempt.
It's just an accident.
It was an accident. He absolutely not a suicide attempt. Well, he was released and he was let go. Bail was not revoked. He was back out on bail. He was out. But then it was April that he was then sectioned because his behaviour became more... He had a breakdown, essentially.
I'm not surprised, but no one... 46 pills...
That's not an accident.
That is not an accident. Nobody necks 46 pills.
No.
A fortnight later, a 3-day extradition hearing begins. And after a long legal battle, Shirin Devani was finally extradited from the UK to South Africa on the 7th of April 2014.
That's 4 years after the murder.
Yeah, but only 3 years ago from now.
Oh my God, there's stuff going on with this case until as late as this year.
Upon arrival, he was arrested, charged, and ordered to stand trial for allegedly arranging the murder of his wife. How long does it take to fly to Cape Town from here, from Heathrow?
Good question.
Long time.
Yeah, like 9 hours, 10 hours?
I want to know what you do on a flight knowing you're going to be arrested at the other end.
I mean, he has someone taking him, right?
Yeah, I can't believe they let him go unaccompanied.
No, for an extradition to stand trial for murder.
Yeah, that's true. I just had like an image in my head of him just being like with a martini watching Finding Nemo, but I'm sure that's what happened.
I don't think that's what's going on.
In the meantime, what's happening to everyone else? On the 8th of August 2012, Kwabe was sentenced to 25 years. The following week, Mugeni pleads not guilty to murder at the Western Cape High Court in Cape Town. And on the 19th of November, he is convicted of firing the shot that killed Annie. But why so little interest in Umblombo? The police take the extraordinary decision to release him and drop all charges. So he walks out of this.
Again, it's Tongo is sentenced but takes a plea bargain to have his time cut down. Kwabe and Mugeni both face time but reduce sentences because of their plea bargains. And once again, the shot fired is pinned on Mugeni, the only man that didn't take a plea bargain, even though I think the UK Home Office pathologist who reviewed the autopsy and the case said that it was most likely that it was Kwabe that had fired the shot. Again, this just stinks of corruption. They pin the worst crime on the man that wouldn't take the plea bargain and point the finger at Devani. I don't know why such little interest in Umblombo. Is he more powerful than he comes across? Or is it just because he wasn't in the taxi?
I think that's it. He could be the puppet master of the whole thing.
Yeah.
He just wasn't there.
I mean, he was throughout the whole thing. He's the one that came across to be very, very in control and at the centre of all of this. Anyway, that's what happened to those guys. And back to the trial of Shirin Devani. So he was extradited, he lands, he's arrested immediately, and then he is charged with 5 offences. Conspiracy to commit kidnapping, robbery with aggravating circumstances, murder, kidnapping, and obstructing the administration of justice. And he pleaded not guilty to all 5 charges. Devani's trial begins on the 6th of October 2014.
It's my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday for the 6th of October. I'm the 29th. of October.
Oh, are you?
8th October. He takes the stand and tells the court how his whole life came crashing down following Annie's death. And under cross-examination, the key witnesses who alleged Devani's involvement, so Tongo, Kwabe and Oblombo, just continually contradicted their previous statements and each other on the most key elements of the murder-for-hire story. They just couldn't keep their story straight. It's like complete amateur hour during this. But what was the motive? So the prosecution are going full force against Shirin Devani. But what was the motive that they were touting? They argue that Shirin was gay and wanted out of his marriage to Annie. And Shirin shocked the court when he revealed that he was indeed bisexual and had been using gay escorts. He had been on numerous gay fetish sites, and this was proven, and he was on Gaydar under the name Asian Sub Guy, where he described himself in the description section as submissive, filthy-minded, and perverted. I mean, yeah, if you want to do that, cool. Like you were saying before, lots of businessmen.
Oh, yeah, very common, very high-powered men.
Yeah. It's almost like the role you play in life, if you're very dominant in life versus whether you're very submissive in life. People tend to want the opposite when they're in bed. I mean, needless to say, her family were apocalyptic. They were furious. Her dad was, the pictures of him at the trial, he's raging and in tears the whole time. It's heartbreaking to see.
And the surprise testimony comes from one of the escorts that he used, Leopold Lesser, a gay sex worker and dominatrix, also known as the German Master.
Oh my God.
Claiming that Shirin had employed him for his services. The 43-year-old, who specialised in roleplay, S&M and fetishes, also told the court that Shirin was the only client he allowed to sleep over after their meetings.
See, this is the thing, it seems it transcends then just a transactional relationship, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think there was something going on there.
If I were an escort or a sex worker or whatever, like, you're out as soon as your hour's up. Get out. But he was paying a lot of money. I think it was quoted somewhere like £1,500 for an hour with this guy.
Can you imagine paying £1,000 an hour to go to sleep?
It was £1,000 an hour for the S&M and the roleplay and the fetishes. So he was then getting free sleepovers. That's what he was saying. That's what I'm saying. It transcended just this transactional relationship between like a Tom and a sex worker. Lesser said he was the only client of his that he let sleep over.
Lesser also said that Devani has shared his most intimate fears with him, how he could not find a way to break off the engagement with Annie without being disowned by his family. But much of Lesser's testimony was ruled as inadmissible in court. And another piece of evidence also excluded was an email from Shirin's laptop to Lesser in which prosecutors claimed Shirin had made admissions about whether to get married or to come out. However, on the 24th of November 2014, after the close of the prosecution's case, Devani's counsel argued for the case to be dismissed under Section 174 of the Criminal Procedure Act, citing a lack of any credible evidence linking his client to the crime.
And on the 8th of December, the application for dismissal under Section 174 was granted by the Honourable Judge Tavaso, and Devani was acquitted and exonerated of all involvement with the crime. In her judgment, Tavaso ruled there was no credible evidence linking Shirin Devani to the crime, and explained her ruling by saying that the case against him, because it was riddled with inconsistencies and evidence provided by the three men, was flawed. The judge came down hard on the prosecution, telling them she was shocked by the poor quality of their case, given that they had had 4 years to prepare. And Shirin Devani was acquitted in December 2014. So what really happened in this case?
Why were the police so happy to just jump on confessions based on plea bargains? Could it have been a fear around the South African tourism industry?
Yes, I think so. I think that the much preferable outcome for the South African justice system, for South Africa, you know, tourism, is that Devani did this and just used their country as a setting for his diabolical murder plan.
Yeah, it's not very good PR, is it? Someone comes on their honeymoon and gets shot in a township.
Yeah, because they get hijacked and the whole thing is plotted by their taxi driver.
Do we think, obviously, for me, the most intriguing part of the trial is obviously when this German dominatrix turns up out of nowhere. That gives Shirin a It gives him a motive I could understand. I could understand why motive isn't
everything.
It isn't a conviction, you know? I can kind of see the argument of, if Shirin's admitted that he's bisexual, maybe I could see the argument that he wanted to get married, get rid of the wife, so if he was a widower, his family couldn't pressure him to marry again.
Absolutely. You want to play the role of the grieving widower that will never ask to be, never ask to look for another wife again. Absolutely, I can see that. And it could be absolutely clear motivation to kill Annie.
Equally though, medical records from both Annie and Shireen show that just days before the honeymoon, the couple had actively been trying for a baby. So they'd managed to have sex after the wedding a little bit.
And also just this idea, though, that this was slap bang in the middle of the time she was busy saying how much she didn't want to be with him and how she wasn't sure if she ever should have married him and she didn't even want to go on the honeymoon, but they're actively trying for a baby. This just throws so much more fuel on, like, what a weird relationship it was. Or is that just me?
No, I agree.
I think also this argument that a lot of people were making, and I can understand, especially with the background that the families had, being Asian and it just being less of a thing that is that people are open to traditional Asian families, their children being gay. And so is this a motive? He needs to hide the fact that he's bisexual, sleeping with his German dominatrix, and he needs to get rid of his wife. But not many people know, and I was shocked to find out this piece of information, that Shireen Devani's sister is a lesbian. And in court, in South Africa, every day, she was sat there next to her parents, who were also Shireen's parents, with her girlfriend by her side. If they're accepting of her, why would they disown him if he came out?
It doesn't seem like there would be a problem. I think some people would be of the opinion, I'm certainly not, that it's easier to accept a lesbian daughter than it is a gay son.
Absolutely. And this is by no means our opinion on the matter. If you're a lesbian, you're a lesbian. That's not to be undermined or saying it's a phase, you're just like trying out women. No, it is this idea of that, oh, she's sleeping with a woman, but if a man is sleeping with another man, yeah. And I think he felt that they wouldn't accept him. Or is it his own insecurities?
I think it's a stupid argument to be like that his parents would have not been accepting of him
if they're accepting of his gay sister.
Exactly.
I think, yes. But there's also some weird other things that have happened around this case. So after this case happened in 2010 and then the conviction in 2014, after that, until last month, we didn't really look back into this case again. It was all done and dusted. He was acquitted. He's been snapped on London tubes and pictures have been put up on the internet. Like, he's out and about now. He looks wrecked, though. But when I went back to research this case, we were looking up what's happened to people since. And there's some really weird things. Almost like there's some sort of, like, weird curse around this case. So firstly, the gunman, Mugeni, the only one who didn't take the plea bargain, he developed a brain tumour and died in jail in October 2014. Okay, that's one. Annie's father had his arm torn off last year in an accident. Leopold Leiser killed himself last year, apparently due to the stress from the court case, and he was found by a friend, hanged in his flat in Birmingham.
That's a lot of things to go wrong.
Actually, it's been 3 years, well, by this point 2 years since the trial. But then Leopold, there's lots of pictures of him on the internet that he's been papped on the streets.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of pictures. So thank you very much for listening. I think we're not really, I don't think either of us can really say whether Shireen did this or not. What do you think?
My final thought is that it was a robbery that went wrong. I don't think it was orchestrated by Shireen. I think he might be a bit of a weird person. I don't think he orchestrated the killing of his wife.
Yeah, 99% of the time when someone dies, it's the spouse. But I think in this case, I don't think it was Shireen. And I started the research on this case. I think we both started the research on this case thinking absolutely 100% it was Shireen Devani. And anyone I told that we were doing this case on the next episode said, oh, but he did it. And that's why we wanted to do this case, because I don't think either of us think that it was him. But we'd love to know what you think, so please tweet at us, post on Instagram, let us know what you think. You can find us at Red Handed the Pod. We will see you next time.
What are we doing next time? Oh, Lucy Blackman, yeah.
Yeah.
That is the next one we're doing, and we'll probably record it in about an hour. It's
dark.
It's very dark. It's
What's
very
the
dark.
Book called we read for it?
It's called People Who Eat Darkness.
Yeah.
Lucy's alleged killer was named in court by the prosecution as the beast with a human face.
Look forward to that.
Join us next time.
Bye.
See you later.
Hi, I'm Ashley Flowers, creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. Every Monday, me and my best friend Britt break down a new case, but not in the way you've heard before. And not the cases you've heard before. You'll hear stories on Crime Junkie that haven't been told anywhere else. I'll tell you what you can do to help victims and their families get justice. Join us for new episodes of Crime Junkie every Monday, already waiting for you by searching for Crime Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts.